This is how to kill God. This week on Religion for Life, we ask, who is really killing God? Atheists or fundamentalist preachers?
For example, one former Christian said to me, quote, I hated hating people.
Rodney Wilson analyzes deconversion in his book, Killing God, Christian Fundamentalism and the Rise of Atheism. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
This is how to kill God, Holocaust, Crusade, Zionism, Jihad.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. We fell a few thousand short of our goal of 55,000, so if you didn't have a chance to give, it's never too late. Remember, for the month of December, if you become a new member or if you increase your giving over last year, your gift will be matched by a number of local businesses and individual donors. Donate now at kboo.fm/give. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Please stay tuned for Veterans Voice.
Baghdad, dancers of death, murder in the air with the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys, raining destruction, good old boys. Deathbringer in Queen George's eyes, read his lips, war maker lies. Religious Reich's revenging sword, thou shalt kill in the name of the Lord. The sheep and the cattle can't keep from milling. Some are more than ready, some aren't willing. Volunteering in what they're not dying for. The young Republican Guard crying for war. Free speech, as free as it's thought. Controlled behavior reacts as it's taught. Fighting for peace, can't comprehend. Hate out of love is violent pretend.
Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad. Bombs over Baghdad.
Vampires drinking blood and oil cocktails. Violence works, it hardly ever fails. When blind man can't see, he believes blind. Blind obedience is the child of mindless mind. New world order is an old world lie. Fighting for peace, see how they die. Dragging in God as they turn violent. God says nothing, he just remains silent. Stop madmen from running loose. Mother Earth woman can't take the abuse. Living right now is living for tomorrow. Time is saying there's no more time to borrow. Vampires drinking blood and oil cocktails. Their violence works. It hardly ever fails.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Dancers of death.
Murder in the air with the next breath. Macho queens selling war makers' toys.
of death.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Dancers of death.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Dancers of death.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Dancers of death.
Bombs over Baghdad.
Welcome to Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM here in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, and 104.3 FM Albany, Corvallis, and Eugene, or streaming on the World Wide Web at KBOO.FM. And if you want to hear some of our past shows, you can go on the web and go to KBOO.FM/Veterans Voice. Which is one word. I'm Marvin, and here with Angie.
Good morning.
And today we're going to be talking with Hamilton Gregory. He's the author of the book McNamara's Folly: The Use of Low IQ Troops in Vietnam. And we'll get hit, start talking with Hamilton here in just a little bit. And his book is really interesting, and I knew some of these guys. And we wanted to start the show off with Bombs Over Baghdad by our friend John Trudell, who, as most of you folks know, passed away. John was a good guy, a good friend. He was a Navy veteran, and John was just a wonderful great, wonderful activist, and he's going to really be missed. Angie and I did a show last week. Was the show last week? There was some problems with the recruiters out at Franklin High School, and it was pretty messed up. You want to tell them a little bit about it before we get started here?
Basically what happened was there was an equal access recruiting event in which some military recruiters and one booth of two counter recruiters were at Franklin High School, and a group of student protesters from Franklin High School, they made some flyers to pass out. They were educational flyers to pass out to some other students, and the military recruiters didn't like this, and they didn't like that there were student protesters not buying their propaganda. And so in retaliation, the lieutenant colonel from the U.S. military army
recruiting command
in Portland wrote a very poorly written counterintelligence type of propaganda letter to the Portland Tribune and the Selwood Bee, and it basically hinted at these student protesters not actually being students, but they were implants, potentially some outsiders. They were adults, and he asked in his letter, were they armed or were they criminals, and shouldn't they think about what they were doing before they were doing it? And that was really disturbing, because these were in fact student protesters, student demonstrators who did this on their own accord and without any help from any counter recruiters. And actually the counter recruiters didn't even know that that was going to happen. But he also, in his letter, said that there was a risk at having counter-recruiters in the school. Well, I would say that the only risk that there really is the risk of hearing the truth from actual veterans and social workers and former public school teachers that make up the counter-recruiting team. And so we actually, Marvin and I, interviewed one of the students.
Yeah, Aiden.
And his parent was present with us.
Yeah, so, his mother was here.
So we have successfully, I think, disbanded that attempt to discredit us.
Yeah, I think so. Because Angie wrote a letter to the Tribune, and Aiden wrote a letter to the Tribune, and so that was pretty good. But, you know, what they did was really wrong. The principal of the school, her name is the Franklin School, her name is Juanita Valder, and you know, she just tried to get the students to stop and really gave them a hard time. And
if you want to ask her why she did it, her phone number is 503-916-5140. And if you want to ask the colonel, you know, why he accused these kids of having weapons on a school grounds, which is completely idiotic, and trying to, you know, cause a rift within communities. His name is Ernie Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, and his phone number is 503-256-1431. And for them to act like they did is just horrible. And so give them a call and ask them what, you know, why they don't want counter-recruiters in the school and why they accused those children, those, well, they're not children, the young adults, for having, saying they may have weapons, which is completely idiotic. And for him to even say anything like that. I brought up, so I was reading in the Oregonian. And yet, the Oregonian.
I shouldn't have to laugh at that, but unfortunately, I'm laughing in a way that is sarcastic.
Because we've always called it the Oregonian. And there was it's ground troops. There was a survey finds that Americans are split on sending troops to fight the Islamic State. And the question they asked was, would you favor or oppose the U.S. sending ground troops to Iraq and Syria in order to assist groups in those countries that are fighting the Islamic militants? Which is kind of the way they stated it. And what it turned out, it's pretty interesting how this turned out. 47% were in favor, 46% were opposed. And 7% didn't have an opinion. And I thought that was pretty telling, you know. But ground troops just is not the answer to,
I wonder
to
if they would do a follow-up question. Would you send your own kids?
Would you send your kids, yeah. Would you send your child to do that, you know? And we're not getting a lot of pictures and information coming out of the bombings that are being laid on those people of Syria, you know, the civilians. 85% to 90% of all casualties in a war now are civilians, you know. And we're not seeing those pictures, you know. Those bombs are, you know, they're perfect. They hit the target and all that. Well, I found a couple pictures the other day, and I put it up on a Facebook. And it's all children that were in these pictures that were just devastated, you know.
Have you seen that documentary Drone, Marvin?
Yep.
And you saw in that documentary how they actually made these giant screen prints of some of the children that have been killed with the drone strikes. And
it's horrible.
And they're putting on them on the roofs of the buildings in Pakistan. So when the drones fly over, they can see the pictures of the children.
Yep. It's just horrible. Children in wars are just devastated, just devastating. And we're going to get to our guest now. Ed, you got one more thing.
Just ahead, very Angie. Quickly, I wanted to announce something that Marvin and I, I know I'm going to go to, Marvin, you probably will too. This, it is a performance, and it is put on by the Well Arts Institute, and it's called Breaking Rank, and it is about 5 U.S. military female veterans, and they will share their stories of breaking barriers and overcoming odds. And Well Arts Institute is partnering with the Returning Veterans Project and Wise Counsel and Comfort. Again, this is called Breaking Rank, and it is written by female service members. The play will explore the experiences of women in the U.S. Armed Forces. Some have survived tours of duty and combat zones. Some cope with military sexual trauma. All of them share what it was like for them to be living and working in a male-dominated environment. And that is going to be put on February 17th to March 6th. So, that's the Well Arts Institute.
Yeah, they're great people. They do really good stuff. And definitely going to go to that myself. And so I want to get to our guest. Our guest wrote this great book called McNamara's Folly, The Use of Low IQ Troops in the Vietnam War. And his name is Hamilton Gregory, and Hamilton is a former Associated press writer. I didn't know that. And he's the author of best-selling college textbook, Public Speaking for College and Career. He is a Vietnam vet, and he was there 68, I believe. We'll ask him. And, 68, 69.
68, 69? Yeah.
Yeah, me too, buddy. And so we're going to, Hamilton, I want to start out with, give a little bit of your background about, you know, it's in your book, but I want you to tell people why you went in the military.
Well, I was a very patriotic and totally gung-ho pro-war person at that time. And I volunteered to do my patriotic duty. And when I got in, I discovered a lot of things. And one of the horrible things that I discovered was the drafting of men who never should have been drafted. And once drafted, they should have been sent home. But instead, they were sent to advanced infantry. They were sent to Vietnam. And a large number of these men who were not mentally qualified, a large number of these men died in Vietnam. And I am still livid. I'm still angry about what happened to them, as well as other people. But these were the least qualified, the least worthy of being sent into battle. It was horrible.
Yeah, one of the things that as we go on talking and we're going to use some language that is, you know, back then it was used, but nowadays, you know, it's not good to talk. You know, these young soldiers were called morons, and they were called idiots, and you know, they were just called some horrible names by the not only the officer corps, but also the guys, regular soldiers, you know, called them names, you know.
Yeah.
And we're going to use those, you know, those words today. And, you know, it's not how I feel. I know it's not how Angie feels. And I know it's not how you feel, Hamilton.
Right.
But
I just used the language that was used at the time.
Yeah.
The most common term was McNamara's morons.
Yeah. Tell them who McNamara is. Most of our listeners know, but go ahead and tell them who this guy was.
Okay. Robert McNamara was the Secretary of Defense during the early part of the Vietnam War. He worked under, first of all, John Kennedy, and then President Lyndon Johnson. And the reason that McNamara is talked about so much, and the men were called McNamara's morons, is that McNamara and Johnson in 1966 were having trouble rounding up enough men for Vietnam. They were not getting enough volunteers, and the draft had been restored and was being used. And McNamara and Johnson did not want to draft college boys, because that would have made the middle class very unhappy. And, of course, the middle class is very powerful in the political arena. So they didn't want to send college men. And they at that time, they didn't send very many National Guard and Reserves to Vietnam. And, again, these were mostly middle-class men. So Johnson and McNamara came up with the idea of lowering standards, the entrance standards, and drafting these men who had been considered unqualified. In other words, on one day, you're not qualified, you're unfit for military duty, but thanks to McNamara, the next day, lo and behold, you're now ready for the war. You're ready to go into basic training. So that's who McNamara was.
Yeah, McNamara was, you know, they call it McNamara's 100,000. And but it ended up, according, I didn't know this, but, you know, you talk about it in your book, that they ended up taking in 354,000 of these guys.
Yeah.
354,000.
Yeah, the Project 100,000 is sort of misleading to some people. They think there was a total of 100,000. No, the original idea was he was going to take 100,000 a year.
Oh.
And your figure is right. He ended up taking 354,000 men total.
Man, that's just amazing.
And the death rate in Vietnam was staggering. The men who died, the Project 100,000 men who died, the total was 5,478. And that is a fatality rate that was three times that of other GIs. It was horrible.
Yeah. It's going through your book. I saw your book, I think it was in Vietnam Veterans Against the War's newspaper, and they did they talked about your book. So the first thing I did was go find your book, I got your book and I sat and I read Hamilton. I sat and read it. It took me a day and a half, to read your book. But I just sat and read your book and because I knew some guys like this, but. You know, you came in contact with these guys early.
Yeah.
Go ahead and tell our listeners how you, the first one you met, how you met this poor guy.
Yeah, it was my first day in the Army. It was in Nashville, Tennessee, at the Armed Forces Induction Center. And I'd volunteered. This was the summer of 1967. I'd volunteered, and I was sitting in a big room in the induction center. There were about 100 of us waiting to be shipped off to Fort Benning to begin basic training. And a sergeant came into the room and he said, okay, you guys are going to Fort Benning soon. And then he said, is there anyone here a college graduate? And I raised my hand and he motioned me to follow him down a hallway. And there was a young man on a bench and he told me, his name, Johnny Gupton. And by the way, I've changed the names to protect their privacy. Okay, Johnny Gupton, he said, I want you to take charge of Gupton. I want you to go with him every step of the way to Fort Benning. And he said, make sure he doesn't get lost. He's one of McNamara's morons. Mm. I had never heard the term. I didn't know what he was talking about. And I was surprised that he would openly insult Gupton, you know, right in front of him. He sent me and Gupton on a, you know, the bus and then the plane to Fort Benning. And on the way, I tried to make small talk with this guy. I asked him what state he was from. He didn't know. I found out later he was from Tennessee. He was from one of the poverty pockets in the impoverished eastern part of the state, mm-hmm. in the Appalachian Mountains. And, he didn't know anything about what was going on. He didn't know what basic training was all about. He didn't know there was a war going on. And then during basic training, he was pathetic. I had to make his bunk for him because he didn't know how to make up his bunk. I had to tie his boots for him every morning until there was another trainee, a good friend of mine, who had the patience and took the time to teach him to tie his shoes, tie his boots. He didn't know his left from his right, so he had trouble with marching. When the sergeants were screaming at him, he was terrified and confused. And on the rifle range, he was erratic and dangerous and handling his rifle. And the sergeants were afraid that he would accidentally shoot himself or someone else. And so they finally put him on permanent KP, mm-hmm. you know, working in the mess hall all day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went through basic training with this guy, and then toward the end of basic, I suffered heat exhaustion and was taken to the hospital. And after I got out of the hospital, I was sent to an outfit called Special Training Company, which was supposed to be for people who had failed basic training or who had to be physically rehabilitated and so on.
Mm.
And that's where I really got to see these men. There were dozens of them who had failed basic training. And they were really pathetic. They did not have the mental power to do the physical part. They couldn't do things like the grenade throw, not because they were necessarily weak, but because they couldn't understand the mental part of throwing a grenade.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't succeed on the rifle range because you had these pop-up targets. To qualify, you had to on a hillside, there were these pop-up targets at different intervals, like 50 meters, 75 meters, 100 meters, and so on, scattered around, and they popped up for only 5 seconds. So you had to be able to be quick-witted. You had to foresee the pop-up and then reposition your rifle and take aim. They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it in time. And so they just weren't qualified for Vietnam, for combat. And they ended up going to Vietnam. One of the good things that I point out in the book is that a lot of these men were protected by sergeants and officers who saw their deficiency and you know, protected them, like keeping them out of direct combat. But obviously, from the fatality figure, not all men were protected.
Right. You know, I thought one of the things that was interesting in your book, that why they thought you were one of McNamara's 100,000.
Yeah, I just thought,
oh man, go ahead and tell them.
Well, I had sort of a goofy face to begin with, but when they shaved all my hair off, I looked especially goofy, and so there was an assumption made that I at different points that I was one of McNamara's morons, and you know, some of the sergeants and officers got quite a surprise. Like at this special training company, none of the men could because of their mental limitations could. You had to rest on one knee and throw a grenade to a giant target, sort of like a bullseye.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the men could even come close to the bullseye. They couldn't come close to the target, much less hit the bullseye. And one of my favorite memories is that when it was my turn, I threw the grenade and it headed towards the bullseye. There was a sergeant standing on the bullseye because he knew none of the special training men. In special training, he was surprised.
Yeah, I can imagine he was really surprised. So. That you could throw it like that, but what was the rate of the AWOL? Did these guys go AWOL? You know, how did they make it?
Well, I don't have any figures about how many of them ever went AWOL or deserted or something like that, but. The ones that I knew at Fort Benning, there's no way they could go AWOL. I mean, they couldn't pack their suitcase or make their bunk. They couldn't do something like navigate their way out of this big
camp,
fort and find transportation and go somewhere. I mean, they just were not mentally able. The ones I knew, but. They just shouldn't have been there.
Yeah, I understand. There's just no way they should have been there. You know, the McNamara's morons, as they called them, most of them, like you were saying, couldn't get through basic training. And then they got sent to the special training company.
Yeah.
And tell them what you guys did in that. You didn't go. You went there because you got sick.
Yeah, so. But I was in the training with them, and I observed very closely the problems they had and their inabilities. They should not have been sent on from special training. The Army was not supposed to graduate or, you know, send these men on down the line to Vietnam unless they passed basic training.
Right.
But what happened was. There's a loophole, and if the company commander deems that a man really could pass basic training if he wanted, but he's probably a malingerer, he's probably pretending not to be able to pass basic training, he could, quote, administratively pass the man.
Mm.
And that's what they did with the men that I knew at special training. They administratively passed them, to use that term they used. And there was a lot of cheating all along the line. Men like in basic training, in one particular case, the company commander had the young-looking sergeants shave their heads so they look like trainees, and had them swap shirts because that was the way you were identified when you went through the physical test and the rifle range and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so these young-looking, shaved-headed sergeants would wear the shirt of one of the low IQ men and have that man's scorecard in his hand. And so they would go and take the test for them. And so you ended up having a man who was low IQ, but on his Army records, he scored very high in everything.
Mm.
And sent on to Vietnam, sent on towards Vietnam.
Right. So they would, in your book, I was the parts that really interest me about the physical, that these guys having to go through that training, physically, they couldn't do it. Like you were
right.
talking about the rifle range, but just physically, these guys couldn't do it. I mean, they couldn't do it.
Yeah, there was there were parts like there was. A little exercise called the run, dodge, and jump, where you had to jump over a ditch and negotiate through these little barriers, and you had to follow the arrows. And these men could do it, but they were slow. They would, you know, they'd have to stop and figure out which way the arrow was pointing and all that. And so they would fail that particular event.
Jeez, that's just I'm just amazed, you know, because I knew some of these guys in Vietnam. I knew some of these guys. So when you got you finally got through with this you got out of the special training company. How many of the guys got out at the same time? Do you remember how many of the guys that got
I was talking about how the men were administratively passed.
Right.
That happened after I graduated or went through and was sent on to advanced training, but I found out about it later.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Hamilton Gregory. He's the author of McNamara's Folly, The Use of Low IQ Troops in the Vietnam War. And Hamilton went through the special companies because he had been hurt, but these low IQ men were going through it. Is there any, when you look back on it and with all these men, is there anything that really ran through all of them? You know, was there certain feature, certain, you know, economic, what I'm trying to say? Is there, was there anything that, you know, you could tell about these poor men?
Well, it's hard to generalize. Some of them, were white middle class, came from white middle class families, but most of them were from low income. At Fort Benning, most of them were from a small town. There were white men from small towns and Appalachian communities, a lot of Appalachian mountain people. And then low IQ Hispanics and blacks. I'm often asked, well, weren't these guys mostly minorities? No, most of them were white. At Fort Benning, I just roughly estimate that 85% of the men were white.
Mm-hmm.
And then the rest were Hispanics and blacks, but it's hard to generalize. The common thread was that they were slow in their thinking. They were just slow. They could often do things like going back to the rifle range. If you on a target that was fixed, and you aimed at the target, a lot of these men could hit that target. But it was when you got them out to the range where there were pop-up targets spread on a hillside they were slow. They were just too slow in their thinking to react. And of course, in combat, you've got to be smart. You've got to be quick-witted.
Yep.
You can't be slow thinking.
Yep. That's
and
true.
That's the reason they should not have been passed on, and they should never have been sent into combat.
Were very many of these guys were given discharges through going through basic?
Not many. There was
really
because at that time there were a large number of men going AWOL and deserting.
Oh yeah.
And so the military was faced with severe manpower shortages, and the word was out to the battalion commanders and the company commanders and so on, don't send anybody home and don't let, make sure that none of these men go AWOL.
Mm-hmm.
They were just trying to retain everyone. And there were so many cases where sergeants would tell me, God, in the old days, we would have sent this guy home weeks ago.
Yeah.
But we can't do that now. They're saying you can't send anybody home. You can't discharge anybody.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So did you follow? You went to Vietnam in 68.
Yeah.
But you after you went through the this training and you finally got out of basic and then you went to your AIT, were you treated any different? Were you still treated because you said because you looked funny with your ears and stuff?
No,
were you treated
any
different?
Well, I was in an unusual situation. When I finally got out of Fort Benning and sent on to advanced training, I went to Army Intelligence School.
Oh, okay.
And then in Vietnam, I wore civilian clothes and used a false name, and I posed as a journalist.
Okay.
And I recruited agents for missions into Cambodia. So I'm very unusual.
Yeah, yeah. So for these, because you talk in your book about these guys in Vietnam. That most of them did end up going to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Well, going back to the figures, there were, we said a moment ago, there were 354,000 men in Project 100,000.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them went to Vietnam, and about half of them who went to Vietnam were assigned to combat.
Mm.
So that's the best I can tell you about.
Yeah.
About who was there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you talked about, I've got personals, I'll talk a little bit about some of these guys, but you talk about some of these guys, especially the guy, tell them about the guy that lost part of his rifle. Do you remember that in your book?
He lost his bolt of his Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah, it took me a minute.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how I mentioned the men in Vietnam, even though I was in intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
My Vietnam anecdotes and stories are from people I've interviewed, like at VA hospitals over the years,
mm-hmm.
and their websites or their books, their memoirs and mm-hmm. things like that. But yeah, the man who lost the boat on his rifle. I quote a captain who was in an infantry outfit,
mm-hmm.
and he said that one of the men went out on patrol,
mm-hmm.
and when the unit came back in the next morning, one of the other soldiers came to this captain and said, I forget the name I gave him.
Yeah.
It was not his real name.
Right.
So-and-so did not have a bolt in his rifle.
The bolt is, for people who don't know what we're talking about, the bolt is what puts the bullet into the chamber of the rifle.
Yeah.
It comes out of the magazine, and the bolt brings the bullet into the rifle and shoves it into the barrel to be fired out. So
yeah.
He didn't.
So, bottom line, the bolt is very important.
Very important.
And so when he was told that this man went out without a bolt in his rifle, he said, "What in the world are you talking about?" And the soldier who's doing the reporting says, sir, it's true. This man said he didn't have a bolt, but don't worry about it. Nobody will notice. And so the so this officer called in the man who had lost his boat. Oh, and the boat was apparently it was thought that the boat was lost while the man was cleaning his rifle in gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And taking his rifle apart and was cleaning in gasoline, and then he accidentally threw out the boat when he was through with the process. That was the theory.
Yeah, wow, that's just amazing.
But anyway, he called in the man and confronted him, and he said, that the man who had a speech impediment was not at all flustered or embarrassed or apologetic or anything. The man simply said with his speech impediment, I washed my boat.
He lost his bolt.
Washed my boat. And so the officer who tells this story says that he immediately sent the man to a rear area.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, I was in an infantry unit, and we had some of these guys, and a lot of them, you're right, that they kept them in jobs in the rear, you know, a lot of them. But
yeah,
some of them that were just barely functional, you know, could fire their rifle and things that we were really afraid that they would get flustered and just start shooting at anything that moved. That's what we were afraid of. We were afraid that they would get scared and run off.
Yeah.
You know, and we were worried that that they would drop their rifle and or whatever, or not have rounds in their rifles. And these, you know, Hamilton, these guys were nice guys, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys were really, really nice guys. And, but they hadn't, they really didn't really have common sense, you know?
Yeah.
But the basic things that we would think would be common sense that they wouldn't have. I remember going to the field and some of these guys couldn't remember what to put in their rucksack.
Yeah.
You know, they couldn't, they didn't know that they had to take extra water, or they had to have, clean socks.
Yeah.
That they had to, that we all carried our, our rations and all that. They couldn't, they just didn't remember it.
Yeah.
And I remember squad leaders going, really paying attention to these guys, and having to go up to them and say, okay, show me this, show me that, show me your socks, show me your soap, show me how much water do you have, and just having to really go through all that simple stuff that these guys should have known.
Yeah.
But they didn't. I mean, they were good guys, man. You could talk to them and have fun with them, but boy, you're right. They should never ever have been, one thing, in the military, and two things, in Vietnam, and the third thing, never should they have been in an infantry unit.
Yeah,
they should never have been in an infantry unit. I remember Hamilton. I remember especially two of these guys. One was from the South, and one was from Chicago area. And I remember them getting mail, and I remember them, looking at their mail and not opening. They didn't open it, And I said, "Why come you guys? Who's the letter from?" And probably my ma, or something. I said, "Why don't you read it?" They couldn't read.
Yeah.
These guys couldn't, if they could read, it was very poor. They couldn't, and I remember I said, "Well, I'll read it for you." So I would open their mail and I'd read it.
Yeah.
I would look at the writing whoever wrote these letters, their mama or their daddy or their sister or brother, they couldn't write very well. You know,
yeah.
It was really kind of hard to read their writing sometimes, but, yeah. You know, I knew everything about their families, you know, and so then, you know, I'd write letters home for them. I would write, you know, I'd say, well, what do you want to tell your mama, you know, and they would say, well, tell my mama I'm okay.
Yeah.
You know, that was the first thing they always went, tell mama I'm okay. And so I, you know, I'm okay. And then they just ask how my daddy is, or ask how my sister, and just really basically simple, really simple, simple things. And they just couldn't, you know, they just, man, you know, they were good guys, but they just, Hamilton.
Yeah.
They just shouldn't have been there. And both these guys got wounded.
Oh gosh!
And I'm not sure if they died or not, but I know that they did. Both of these guys got wounded, and
gosh!
But you just, you know, this is, you know, we was there in 68, and to this day I still think about those guys. You know,
yeah.
I still
wonder
about these guys.
Yeah, well, you were like a lot of the men that I discovered in the process of my research. Men like you who help these guys out with things like you mentioned, reading.
Yeah, they couldn't
mail
read.
To them and,
couldn't read.
And helping them out in those areas. Mm-hmm. And as we discussed a few minutes ago, you know, sometimes protecting them, keeping them from going into combat.
Yep. We
but
had.
There was,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, there was the concern, as you touched on this, that they were a danger to themselves or to other mm-hmm. men in the unit.
Oh, they were definitely a danger. I remember the squad leader, the platoon, you know, in Vietnam, you know, a platoon leader is supposed to be an officer, but, you know, a lot of times we didn't have enough officers, so it would be an enlisted guy, you know. And if it was an enlisted guy, he would be more sympathetic to the guy. If it was an officer, you know, not so sympathetic to this guy, you know. And so, you know, we would ask us, you know, kind of keep an eye on this guy for us, okay? You know?
Yeah.
And you know, I remember these guys would talk, Hamilton, about, you know, they would say things like, you know, I never got this much food in my life. You know, they would talk about, you know, living where they grew up, you know, not having food, you know, not having enough food.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
I think in your book you mentioned about some criminals.
Oh, well, yeah, talk about that.
I'm kind of curious about that.
Yeah, toward the end of the, toward the latter years of the war, not even the induction of these low IQ men could fill the ranks, and there were so many casualties in Vietnam and so many units shorthanded that the military started doing something that it's never liked to do, but it felt desperate and it did it, and that is it issued a lot of what they call moral waivers. That is, men who normally would not be inducted because they had been convicted and had prison time for, you know, mm-hmm. Armed robbery and
theft,
assault and battery and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they took a lot of these men in, and that turned out to be a real bad thing for the military, because in the, as I say, the latter years of the war, there were lots of disciplinary problems, cases of men killing their NCOs or officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I have in the book a quote from Colin Powell, who was a major at the time, and of course later a four-star general.
And My Lai denier.
Yeah. Right. And Colin Powell, and I mentioned in the book, he said that he would move his cot at night to different places in his tent because he didn't want to be a target, and a fragging. And for those who don't know what fragging is, it comes from fragmentation grenade. And the disgruntled person could roll the grenade into the tent in the middle of the night. And the grenade, when it exploded, of course, it destroyed any fingerprints or evidence. And so there was a very serious problem in the Army and the Marine Corps, fragging. So I've got a lot of information on fragging.
Yeah, that's fragging. That's a whole nother story, isn't it, buddy?
Yeah.
Boy, that's a really a big got to be a really big problem. And Angie, my partner here, my pal, yeah. Angie brought this up about. Because these guys were taken advantage of too by well, you got money stolen from you. Tell them about that. Tell them what they did to you guys.
Oh gosh, we were in a reception station where you stay a week before you go into actual basic training,
mm-hmm.
And we were all set to to one night to. Next morning, one afternoon, go. We were all set to go to our basic training unit, and there were about eight of us who were held back. And one of the sergeants at the reception station said that our orders had been misplaced, and we would have to spend one more night at the reception station, and then go to basic training in the morning. And so. We were taken to this barracks and introduced to another sergeant who said, well, I'll let you spend the night here in my barracks. And so he took us in, and when we were getting ready to get in our bunk to go to bed, he said, now, I don't want you to use the wall lockers because you'll just stink them up if you put your stuff in the wall lockers. So we obeyed him, and we just, took off our clothes and dumped them on the floor. And the next morning we discovered that during the night someone had come in and stolen all the cash out of our wallets. And we had a lot of cash because we had been given advance pay to buy things like shaving cream, mm-hmm. and stuff like toothbrushes and stuff. And I won't go into all details about how I complained and so on, but I looked around at the other men, and all of us, I could see why we were chosen. All of us looked like we were not the kind of guys who were bright enough to complain and raise a stink and go to the MPs and all of that. That was my first instance of the men being ripped off, and I saw many cases of this. There were so many tricks and pranks, and these low IQ men would be cheated out of their money. They would be tricked into doing KP in the mess hall for other men. They had pranks played on them, like one of the favorites was right before you woke up in the morning, someone would come in with a can of shaving cream and fill your boots with shaving cream. And they did it right before you woke up so that the foam would be real puffy, look like whipped cream.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing that these men had to endure.
Yeah, it's just horrible, just horrible. We don't have much time. Did you followed up on a couple of these guys, and how about the very first guy, the guy you took with you to basic, the guy called him a McNamara's moron right in front of him?
Yeah, right. Well, he did not. I thought he would go to special training camp. I thought I'd see him there. I thought he would fail basic training and he'd go to special training company. I'd see him there, but I never saw him again because he was one of those that involved in the trickery where a sergeant. With a shaved head would go through and take all the tests for him. So I found out later, after researching this book, putting it together, I found out later that he he went on through basic and advanced infantry and all that, and he went to Vietnam, and I found out that he survived Vietnam because there was a friendly sergeant who looked after him, and this sergeant had grown up with a, they used to call him mentally retarded, and they now call him intellectually disabled,
right.
sister.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very sympathetic to this young man, whom I call Gupton.
Mm-hmm.
And he took care of him, and Gupton survived, and he's dead now. I don't know his story after that, but he died at, I don't know, age 50 or something,
mm-hmm.
In his hometown in Tennessee. So
he did make it. He did make
it. Yeah, he made it through.
Yeah, that's good. I really want to thank you, Hamilton, for coming on and talking about your book. It's really really a good book, and it really shows a part of the Vietnam War and the military in general about how they treat people. And you did a great job, buddy, and I want to thank you for writing this book. I really do. I want to thank you for it. It's very, very good.
Well, thanks, Marvin. I appreciate your interest.
Yeah, it was great. And thanks, buddy. And I hope to talk with you again.
I hope so.
Okay, buddy. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. He's really interesting. You know, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about these guys. I don't know if you knew any of them in the Navy, of these kind of guys.
Yeah, there's a couple of people that came to mind. I'll never forget them. One guy, he just would walk around with his fist clenched all the time and kind of staring at the ground. And he was a sonar tech. And it didn't take very long for people to figure out that there was something
wrong with him.
There was something off.
Yeah.
And they didn't really want him to work on that equipment because that equipment's, you know, thousands of dollars, so they actually just gave him a clipboard to walk around with.
Really?
Pretty much, yeah. And then there was another guy, he was a bosun's mate, and he would talk to himself all the time, just go on and on and on and talk to himself. And you know, he was probably some kind of had a schizoaffective issue going on, and I don't know how they ever got in. But then again, If these recruiters have to make their numbers and their quotas, they're just going to pass people through, and they slip through the cracks, and somehow they end up in there. And
God, it's just amazing. You know, like I was telling Hamilton, you know, is I grew up poor. I really grew up poor. We were dirt poor people. And I remember when I had to go to the Army. And I remember, you know, meeting these guys like Hamilton was talking about, and you could just look at them,
mm-hmm.
Angie.
Yeah.
You could just look at these guys and just know there was something wrong with them.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was saying, you know, in Vietnam, these guys should never have been in Vietnam. They should never have been in the infantry. They should never have been in the military, you know. And what he was talking about, that they lowered all the scores and everything. Well, they did that not too long ago now.
Mm-hmm.
Remember? They were needing troops, so they lowered the scores, and they got these guys in there that had police records and different things. And then when they did that, look what happened. And, you know, they went to these war zones. And that's when they got, you know, all this crime in the military,
mm-hmm.
and all that. And you know,
they get dishonorable discharges, or other than honorable discharges, they have higher suicide rates, and they also aren't able to access the health care at the VA either.
Yep, these guys should never. Well, we're just about out of time again, and we'll be back.
Well, hopefully the war will be over by next month.
Hopefully. We'll be back on January 15th again at 9 a.m. And this is Veterans Voice Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM. And there it is.
At the end of the early British wars, the
young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Book of Mormon, a play running from Friday, November 27th through Saturday, December 19th, presented by Triangle Productions in Portland. The Book of Mormon is a new musical comedy where Mormon missionaries meet Ethel Merman. Again, that's The Book of Mormon, playing from December 19th at Triangle Productions, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Everything's coming up roses.
And this is KBOO Portland. Time is 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, it's Chris Andre with Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints, presenting an encore broadcast of a recent interview with independent filmmaker and journalist David Sheen. At 11 on the Radio Zine, Iraq vet and writer Roy Scranton discusses his book, Learning to Die in the Anthropocene. At 11:40, we hear the sixth partnership show with Oregon Community Media, with a focus on housing issues and the housing crisis taking place all over the state of Oregon. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Our matching challenge is still in effect for new members and members who increase their yearly pledge. To take advantage, please go to kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.